Greetings, friends. I'm John Haspel. This is a Dhamma talk from Cross River Meditation Center in Frenchtown, New Jersey. If you find benefit from this talk, please support the restoration, the preservation, and the presentation of the Buddha's Dhamma with your donation at becoming-buddha.com. Thank you. Peace. And a common theme of the Dhamma, of keeping the Dhamma pure. And I think some people get a little tired of hearing me say that, but I only say it because it's something that the Buddha continually came back to. I'm teaching you actual suttas that the Buddha taught. These are his words, not mine. And many, many suttas are about keeping his Dhamma pure because he understands the compulsive need for mind rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths to start attaching things to his Dhamma and eliminating things that they don't like and still consider themselves as practicing something that will bear fruit. And as soon as the Buddha understood this clearly, because he's the guy that figured this out, as soon as you compromise reality and substitute something rooted in a fabrication, rooted in ignorance, you've destroyed the reality that you've established. Because now you have, even if it's a slight fabricated view, which there really is no such thing. Our views ultimately are either based on fabrications or they're based on understanding. And there is no middle way there. The middle way is in the practice itself. It's the middle. The Buddha defined the middle way as the Eightfold Path. It had nothing to do with effort, meaning that you do have to put some effort, but it has to be right effort, the sixth factor of the Eightfold Path. So here, I'll skip the introduction. A group of the original Sangha went to the Buddha and said, we want to start wandering around the countryside, leave the Sangha, and ostensibly they're going to teach the Dhamma. But the Buddha understood the conditions. He did the same thing. He wandered around northern India and southern Nepal. He knew all the almost endless number of so-called spiritual teachers, all teaching something contradictory to themselves, but everything that they taught contradicts what the Buddha taught. And so he understood that they're going to go out into the countryside now and they're going to be influenced by all those things out there. All the, you know, this is the next great teaching and this is the greatest lineage and we have the best gods, etc., etc. And so his choice of how to explain this is interesting, and it teaches something important. Rather than just teaching them directly, he called in one of his teachers, one of his head teachers, Sariputta, who was one of the Buddha's chief disciples throughout his teaching career, because he is the example of a teacher teaching authentic Dhamma. And so this, and one of the reasons why I'm doing this today, and I put the beginning of our Dhammapada study back a week, most of it had to do with scheduling, but it allowed me to teach this sutta, which is a direct teaching for those that would share the Dhamma with others, but most importantly, those that would teach the Dhamma in a formal way. And so this cycle coming through this next 26 classes, our teachers are going to start teaching here. They taught online on our retreat, but they're going to start teaching right here, and two of them are right here. So Jen's going to teach the first non-John class in 2 weeks from today, I think. And then Ron will follow, then Kevin, and then Matt about every 4 or 5 weeks. This is an appropriate sutta, but besides our retreat, this is the next generation of Dhamma teachers that are really coming into their own in the next 26 classes. So this kind of gets it going in the right direction. On one occasion, the Buddha was with the Sakyans, so that's Siddhartha Gautama's clan, at Devadaha, which is near Anathapindika's monastery, but nobody really knows. They know, but I don't know. Maybe 10, 15, 20 miles away, something like that. At the time, a large number of disciples were headed to outlying areas. They went to the Buddha for guidance. Upon arrival, they bowed in respect for their teacher and sat to one side. Great teacher, we want to go to an outlying area to take up residence. The Buddha responds, have you spoke with Sariputta? No, we have not spoken with Sariputta. Well, speak with Sariputta. Sariputta is wise and is a great help and support for those living a life well integrated with the Eightfold Path. You're saying if you really want to take the Eightfold Path out into the world, away from the safety and focus of the Sangha, you need some guidance. Go talk to Sariputta. The group left to find Sariputta, not far, sitting under a kasha tree. Upon arrival, they exchanged courteous greetings and again sat to one side. Friend Sariputta, we want to take up residence in an outlying area. We spoke to our great teacher, and he advised us to speak with you. Sariputta responds, friends, in foreign lands there are noble ones, Brahmins, householders, and contemplatives. The wise ones will question you thusly. So he's saying you'll run into a myriad of different teachers, and the wise ones, you'll know who the ones that are teaching authentic Dhamma or who represent that by asking these questions. Who is your teacher and what does he teach? Immediately they want to know, where is this teaching coming from? And non-Dhamma teachers will ask the same question, but they'll be threatened by it. Have you listened well to the teachings from the wise ones? Have you grasped them well? Have you attended to them well? Have you considered them well? Have you penetrated them well by means of discernment, so that in answering, you will speak in line with what the Buddha has said? The wise teachers that they would encounter are redirecting their thinking back to the pure Dhamma. They continue with the questions. Are you certain you will not misrepresent the Buddha's Dhamma with what is fabricated and false? Will you always answer in line with the Dhamma, so that anyone whose thinking is in line with the Dhamma will have grounds for criticizing you? Friends, Sariputta, we would travel great distances to hear your explication of your words. It would be for our long-term benefit if you would teach us your meaning. In that case, listen and pay close attention. Friends, in foreign lands, there are noble ones, Brahmins, householders, and contemplatives. The wise ones will question you thusly. Who is your teacher and what does he teach? Having been asked, you should reply skillfully. Our teacher teaches the subduing of passion and desire. So immediately, as a representative of the Dhamma, you're not getting into a social conversation trying to figure out what these people need so you can provide them, because you can only provide them the Dhamma. And that's where you speak directly about the Dhamma. And you describe it. If this is what you're looking for, if what you're looking for is a way to subdue the passions and desire, then me as the Dhamma teacher, I can teach you that. But it's also important to remember, that's all I can teach you. I can't teach you about Avalokiteshvara. I can't teach you about bowing 108 times. I can't teach you about the benefit of chanting, because there isn't any. I can't teach you anything as a Dhamma practitioner except the Dhamma. And that is quite in contrast to most spiritual teachers, who will teach just about anything that they think will provide them a means for being a teacher. And so you'll create all kinds of specialness about what you're teaching, but not having anything really special or extraordinary about it. If you are then asked, why does your teacher teach this? What is the purpose? When asked, you should answer, our teacher teaches his Dhamma for subduing passion and desire, for forms, for feelings, for perceptions, for fabrications, and for consciousness. Adam, that last is a reference to something called the five clinging aggregates, and I teach that often, but not in this class, but simply so you understand it. Form, feeling, perceptions, fabrications, and consciousness, meaning ongoing thinking rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths, is the Buddhist description of the personal experience of ongoing stress and suffering. And as you continue to come to class, that'll become more clear. And I'll talk to you a little bit about the website and where you could find references to that too, before we're done. If you are then asked, what is the danger, the drawback of not subduing passions and desires for forms, for feelings, for perceptions, for fabrications, for consciousness? When asked, you should answer, inflamed by passion, one is never free from craving for form, for feelings, for perceptions, for fabrications, and consciousness. Understanding the Dhamma a little broader, what Sariputta is saying, if you want to end stress and suffering, the stress and suffering of ignorance, of maintaining anatta, fabricated views of self in relation to the world, you'll address the Dhamma this way because this is what it will bring you. If this, again, if this is what you're looking for, then this is the Dhamma will provide that. The Sariputta is stressing the single importance of always maintaining fidelity to the Dhamma, and this is how you do it. These are the things that you let people know and the things that you address within the Dhamma. Then, from any change to any type of these phenomena, there will be sorrow, regret, grief, confusion, and despair. Form, feeling, perceptions, fabrications, and consciousness are the vehicle for continuing ignorance in the world. It also describes stress and suffering. It's the desire, usually the unknowing desire, to maintain that fabricated self that causes all the stress and suffering for yourself in the world. If you want to get rid of that, again, you take to the Dhamma. When one continues to cling to those passions, then any change to any of the aggregates will always result in sorrow, regret, pain, and great confusion and despair. When the Buddha describes suffering, he describes it in the most obvious way. Birth is suffering, sickness is suffering, aging is suffering, death is suffering. Not getting what is desired is suffering, getting what is undesired is suffering. And then the Buddha would always end that description of dukkha, of stress and suffering, by saying, in short, the five clinging aggregates are stress and suffering. So he's not referring to anything that's terribly complicated to understand, except we don't understand five clinging aggregates right off the bat. Like, you've heard no reference to this before, but you'll understand it and you'll see that the Buddha is simply describing a fabricated self, fabricated by its own ignorance, that is prone to stress and suffering. End that ignorance and there is no stress and suffering. There's nothing left to provoke that type of stress and suffering and despair. Continue, skipping over a little bit of commentary. The Buddha, Sariputta continues, understanding the danger thusly, our teacher teaches the subduing of craving for form, for feelings, for perceptions, for fabrications, and for consciousness, craving to maintain our own fabricated views of self in relation to the world. If you are then asked, what is the benefit of subduing passions and desire for forms, for feelings, for perceptions, for fabrications, and for consciousness? When asked, you should answer, free of passions, one is free from craving for form, feeling, perceptions, fabrications, and consciousness. Then, any change to any of these phenomena, they will not experience sorrow, regret, pain, grief, confusion, and despair. An awakened human being who understands the true nature of self, when there's any change to that self, will not experience any type of reaction in their minds. To an uninformed person, a person who does not understand the Dhamma, any change is a challenge to the self, and it is felt as some form of stress and ongoing distraction. And as soon as that develops in this moment, that mind will start grasping after the next thing it needs to maintain these fabricated views. And in that moment, that mind is distracted out of its body, and that human being is no longer living the life that is occurring. They're living in that fabrication now, that fabrication of grasping and maintaining a fabricated view, which is how most people go from cradle to grave. We don't realize it. We don't understand the nature of our discontent. That discontent is what drove Siddhartha Gautama to seek and understand it. And as soon as he went out, this is an important part of this sutta. As soon as he left the palace grounds, took up homelessness, and started wandering around northern India, he encountered all these myriad of teachers. And he studied with some of the most prominent ones and mastered their teachings, particularly Olarakalama and Uddeka Ramaputta, the prominent spiritual teachers of his time. He mastered them and rejected them out of hand as not leading to his goal of understanding why the human beings suffer and what is their contribution to it. That's all that he cared about. Of course, that is really the great question of mankind, except we get distracted. We try to substitute for our suffering by coming up with magical and mystical establishments of the self. Or that we are constantly being watched by a salvific god or goddesses that will protect us in this dangerous and world that's prone to discontent. Again, that's just an escape from reality, isn't it? And that pernicious belief, again, is carried from cradle to grave throughout our worldly society. When one is free of these passions, they will remain calm and at peace, let go of any fabrication. When we're free of them, our minds are calm and at peace, which is how the Buddha described the quality of an awakened human being. And when you think about that, just backtrack this a little bit. Most people that initially hear that the culmination of this goal is a mind of calm and peace, that'll sound attractive to most people, but it'll also sound kind of insignificant, because they're grasping after continued self-establishment. And what self-establishment is there in calm and peace? True calm and peace means I'm living with a mind united in my body with no self-reference at all. I'm simply what I am. I'm simply a human being living a life without the need for that life to be any different than it. Another way of saying that is I've ceased taking anything personal because I understand the nature of self. And nothing can be personal in this world. Nothing.
John?
Yes, sir.
Is the development of your jhana practice, the actual meditation, both a metaphor and a reflection of the development of your practice? Because,
yes,
as Adam said, he enjoyed the noise of the air conditioner. And in 2 months, he won't see that as a distraction. He won't notice it.
Yes.
So it's both a metaphor and just a reflection.
It is. It's such great insight. The act of jhana meditating, I'm going to repeat your words, just the actual act of meditating is both metaphor for the awakening process and a direct experience of it. Because every time we find that we're distracted by or enjoying the sound of a fan, recognize it, take a breath, unite the mind and a body. We're establishing calm and peace in that moment. We're interrupting the process of ignorance manifesting in thought after thought after thought. Again, that is both metaphor, and the actual experience of awakening. And the only difference, this is what I get for not eating breakfast before I leave. The only difference between that moment of calm and peace and meditation is continuation of it. An awakened human being has developed the Dhamma to the point where their jhana, their concentration, is so profound that it's able to hold in mind all factors of the Eightfold Path, now established in right view, and seeing life as life occurs from a completely impersonal way. But that simple act, in that moment, there's no personality to what's occurring. It's just that breath and that mind united in its body. There's no John in that moment. For beginning meditators, that's all it is. But it's the beginning of awakening. And again, it's so important to recognize that, to recognize deepening concentration, because you're recognizing what it means to be an awakened human being, what it feels like, and how to operate from a concentrated mind. And that takes some living, it takes some getting used to, doesn't it? All of you that have developed it will agree with that, I think. Because there's an aspect as we're developing the Dhamma where we're letting go of the compulsive need for constant distraction, for constant sensual and sensory indulgence, while we're trying to not do that by deepening our concentration. And there is an internal tension and an internal struggle that requires an Eightfold Path. And if it didn't, if that wasn't there, if the nature of ignorance wasn't to cling to fabrications, an awakened human being could say, just go meditate. And like David said, as soon as you united your mind and your body for that split second, you'd be good to go. Because we don't have something called conditioned thinking or confirmation bias, but we do. And so in that moment, and then I start thinking of something else. Now I'm no longer having the experience of awakening because I'm distracted. But that distraction is how we live our life off of our cushion unless we develop jhana meditation. And it is within distraction that ignorance is maintained. Ignorance cannot be maintained in concentration. You may have not heard me say that before, because I don't know that I ever have quite that way. But ignorance is maintaining distraction. That's the point of distraction. You can say, and I'm not saying that these things are all bad, what I'm about to mention, but that's why things like Facebook and Twitter and even the internet, movies, golf, sex, drugs, and rock and roll, that's why they're so appealing to us, because they're distracting. And if you look at the last 20 years, the people who have generated the most wealth have figured that out to a very surgical way. They figured out a way to provide distraction for billions and billions of people that we gleefully take to. And that doesn't mean that you should never be on Twitter, you should never look at Facebook, or never do a Google search. It means you should apply the Dhamma there too and practice wise restraint. And continue. Because of what I did, because when one is free of passions, they will remain calm and at peace. This is the benefit of our teacher's Dhamma. Again, immediately, think of it from the role of a teacher. You're teaching someone directly. This is what you'll get from us. If you want something else, if you want to understand the nature of cosmos or why the moons have appeared behind Pluto, this isn't for you. But if you want to understand how to depersonalize your life so you can maintain calm and peace no matter what's occurring, then it is for you. Friends, if one who had been fettered by unskillful, mental. Friends, if one who had been fettered by unskillful mental qualities were to, through the Dhamma, develop a pleasant abiding here and now, free of passions, upon death and the breakup of the body, they would know a good destination. The Buddha is not talking about this. People get so confused by that. Upon death, they would know a good destination means that they would no longer be generating ignorance. They wouldn't have carried ignorance into that death experience. They would have died as awakened human beings. This is why our teacher advocates the recognition and abandonment of unskillful mental qualities. Boy, I did that. Why, it's mean. I'm going to read my commentary here. As a culmination of the Buddha's Dhamma is to develop a mind of lasting peace and equanimity, the good destination of becoming free of passions is the profound benefit of authentic Dhamma practice. Of course, it's not doing this now, so when I die, I get something else. That contradicts everything the Buddha taught. But you have to understand the Buddha's Dhamma, or your mind will go to, oh, the Buddha's teaching me how I can establish myself outside of human life free of passion. Of course he's not. He's teaching a human Dhamma for human beings to experience in this lifetime, something that he emphasized over and over and over again. It's for now. Friends, if one who had been fettered by unskillful... Boy, it's everywhere. I know what it must be, because I've been using Grammarly. That must be in my spell check or something. Yeah. I must have entered it. Sorry about that. Friends, if one who had been fettered by unskillful mental qualities were to continue clinging to passions, clinging to ignorance, and clinging upon death and the breakup of the body, they would know a bad destination. It simply means that they wasted a human life. This is why our teacher advocates the recognition and abandonment of unskillful mental qualities. It is for one who enters and remains in skillful mental qualities, unfettered by passions upon death and the breakup of the body, they would know a good destination, meaning they would know. They had the everything the Buddha teaches, he teaches it that it's for you to know, ehipasiko, come and see for yourself. You have to have you can have this experience, and you must have the experience. You must know your awakening, or there's no awakening. It's not something we can bank on by doing a lot of good things. It's something that we know we have it. We have developed it because we experience it. We're not waiting for God to give it to us, or we're not waiting for the fruits of our labor to manifest. The Dhamma is developed right here and right now, and whatever measure of Dhamma whatever measure of right view we might have is what we're expressing right here and right now. That's refined mindfulness. This is why our teacher advocates the recognition and abandonment of unskillful mental qualities. This is what Venerable Sariputta said. Those attending were delighted by his words. Thank you. sorry for the garbled reading there. My fonts are, let me show you so you know. That's the size of the fonts. And I still can't read it. as David said, to me this is just such a beautiful sutta because it gets right to the heart of the matter. And it shows the true compassion that an authentic Dhamma teacher would have. And they have that true compassion because of the Dhamma, because they truly understand the nature of suffering that other human beings have because of their own ignorance of Four Noble Truths. And that's true compassion. That's a compassion that can truly help people, not just treat people not just see people as in constant need of help, because that's not what a Dhamma teacher sees. A Dhamma teacher sees ignorance or wisdom, period. And where we see ignorance as a Dhamma teacher is where we teach. And we teach that to people that are willing to recognize and abandon ignorance. That doesn't mean we have to pre-qualify people with that question. This is what we tell people, and this is what we ask people. And that's what we do here. So thank you for listening. Let's start with David. David, good morning.
Hello, John. I read this sutta very early, and I took it even though I knew little. As my responsibility when I spoke to someone. And it wasn't until we had that discussion about right speech that, along with this and right speech and the aspects of it in regards to timeliness and beneficial, that it taught me not to get too far ahead of my knowledge and the understanding of the person I was speaking to.
Yeah.
But I always would direct that person to your website and never went further than what I understood. And I always found that helpful. Because out in the world, people will ask me questions and I can only tell them what I understand. So I always found this very helpful. So
thank you for that, David. David is expressing the importance to know what you're saying in the Dhamma. And if you know a little bit, you can teach a little bit. But again, and I would say that David used the Dhamma to understand what he knew and what he didn't know, correct? Yeah. And again, the Eightfold Path provides that clarity. We know moment by moment where we are because the Dhamma itself provides internal checks. It's the four levels of jhana meditation is an aspect of that, isn't it? Just so we know what we're doing. We know that it's bearing fruit. So. Jen, good morning.
Good morning. It's kind of dovetailing off what David said. I was hearing that for the first time. I kind of heard that intention in there of providing a very specific framework to the teachers of, if you were asked this question, this is the response you should have. If you're asked this question, this is the response you should have, so that you're kind of creating this sameness in helping people integrate this framework into their minds so that it's the same. You're constantly sort of being told the same thing over and over again so that it gets put into your mind and creates the framework in your mind so that then you're sort of funneled into right thinking.
Yep.
So that was cool to see that, just that little and pieces of the puzzle.
Thank you for that, Jen. That's the right way to put it, too. Funnel your thinking. You
know? Yeah.
That's what you're... Really, I mean, that's what I do as a Dhamma teacher. That's what you're finding out.
Yeah.
It really is that. You know, we keep pointing people back to the Dhamma, back to the Dhamma.
Yeah.
And that really is, as Dhamma teachers are just people that are sharing a Dhamma, that's all we can do, too. And that's not that it's minimal. It's everything. But all we can do as Dhamma teachers or people sharing the Dhamma is keep pointing people and encouraging them to develop it themselves. Because you can listen to, and we kind of went through that with this gentleman I was talking to Ram earlier, you could listen to Dhamma talks over and over and over again, forever, 24/7. And it won't do anything for you unless you actually practice it. It's first, human beings learn first intellectually, but the Dhamma is not an intellectual exercise. There's no useful knowledge in the Dhamma unless you actually develop it. And that's true knowledge. As the Buddha defines knowledge, knowledge is having the experience of what you've learned. And then you make the skillful judgment, is this for me? Does this really work? And we know it works because even our teachers remind us, keep watching it. Look for where it's working in your life and look for where it's not. Because where it's not is where you're not applying it properly. That's all. Ram, how are you this morning?
Doing good. This is a beautiful sutta. I can picture it. They've just come out of the rains retreat.
Yeah.
Monsoon's over. The countryside is green, and they've been taught for 3 months this Dhamma. They've been practicing it, and they're just rearing to go.
Yeah.
To their back, basically back to their clans, and teach.
Yeah.
And you know, and then you know, their days will be, you know, they have their little huts and they're set up somewhere, and they go get their alms and part of the alms process is then they give a little teaching.
Yeah.
And Sariputta is telling them, you know, this is how you do this.
This is how you do it.
And this is how you also keep practicing your Dhamma. This is your practice is this.
Yeah.
And you know, stay the course.
Yeah.
And it's again 2,600 years later. This is completely practical.
Yeah, completely relevant.
As a practitioner, right, as a Dhamma practitioner, you get asked these questions. You know, what is this about?
About some doing passions.
He puts it right in there. He sets the first marker and says, this is what it is, and then builds on that and brings in more and more parts of the Dhamma to its culmination, and it's a short part. You know, we're talking 10 minutes.
Yeah.
And this is how you teach. This is how you show your gratitude for the alms that you have been given. It's a wonderful.
It really is.
Thank you for bringing this in. I have never seen this one.
It's my pleasure. I hope it's inspiring for all of you, but I thought it would be inspiring for our new teachers. And the other subtle aspect here that Sariputta's teaching there as they go out, you know, leave the protection and the safety of the Sangha is how you can determine if someone is an authentic teacher as well before you start listening. Because again, they're going to leave the Sangha and 100 feet from the Buddha, there's going to be another teacher saying, I have the right Dhamma. I have what you should be listening to. And now they know the right questions to ask of them to see if they're an authentic Dhamma teacher as well. And that's an important thing. The biggest difficulty I see, we talked about a little bit earlier, is that people developing the Buddhist Dhamma is when they cling to all the other so-called spiritual, philosophical. I got into a discussion with a gentleman about, I don't want to say who it was, because about a certain philosopher. And it's just, the Buddha didn't teach philosophy. You know, so the philosopher might be right in his assumptions. It has nothing to do with the Dhamma. They're not, the philosopher isn't teaching a noble truth like the Buddha's teaching. And so you can have both. You can have establishments like that in the world that seem useful or altruistic to humanity, when in fact they're just a distraction. And if we hold on to them and try to bring them into our Dhamma practice, even if, because they're significant, because, and then we'll start trying to make the Dhamma fit, just as an example, we'll try to fit the Dhamma into Plato's view of the world, or Socrates' view of the world, or Dogen's view of the world, or Thich Nhat Hanh's view of the world, et cetera, et cetera. And I'm not putting, I didn't really mean to say that, but I'm not putting Mr. Han down. He teaches his own type of Zen Buddhism. It's just different than what the Buddha taught. And that's all that we need to know. We're either going to be Dhamma practitioners or we won't. Good morning, Jen.
You're in.
Oh.
Tim.
Hello, yeah. Tim. I did. Thank you.
Right. Yeah.
I just wanted to hear you again.
Yeah, I know, right?
As usual, the insight and wisdom from the Sangha is amazing.
It is.
You know, and from what I've learned in all my classes is that the Buddha always did things with a reason. He never did anything off the cuff. So it's no surprise that he told, or he had the newly budded Dhamma practitioner see Sariputta, because I think Buddha, to Ram's point, probably thought it'd be better for them to hear from someone else rather than him.
Yep.
And having that enthusiasm put in check is interesting. And to David's point too, I mean, that's such a wonderful application of the Eightfold Path. Because if one does say something and do something over their heads, you're being self-referential. You're doing more harm. You know? And David, I would say that's something I am becoming more and more conscious of, not just with somebody asking a question regarding meditation, but everything that goes on in life in general.
Yeah. That's developing right view.
That's developing right, yeah. Exactly. And it is that point where I'm coming to the point where I actually say, you know what, let me get back to you. Yeah. You know, because...
That's restraint right there.
That's right. Too.
Why is restraint?
So these are things that are happening now, and it's because of this well-structured Sangha and Dhamma practice that it's becoming... I don't have to think about that response. It's becoming my nature. And it's an ongoing, it's ongoing. So that, thank you very much, Dave, for bringing that up, because I think that is something that the underlying, the subtle point of this sutta is just that. I appreciate that. It's interesting in the sutta that Sariputta uses words quite frequently, and those are the words of the passion and desire. I, for one, have always felt that having that dispassion does not, that ends, or subdues that craving. We've all talked about this many times as part of the well-focused study. And one thing I found surprising is that Sariputta never mentions impermanence in this sutta. And I'm wondering why. Is it because...
He does.
Where?
Change.
He says even if there is the slightest change.
Ah,
that's where it's.
There you go. It's subtle.
Yeah.
But yeah, because that's something that when reading this, I understood that, you know, it's this impermanence that's around us. You know, the irony is that our reality really isn't reality, because it's all self-referential. It's all fabricated. And to understand and to recognize, and I always like to use the word reconciliation, that everything is impermanent, so therefore not grasping at the things that are permanent, you won't have those passions and those cravings. So, this was just a chock full of a full Dhamma study right in here, and you know, I'm not going to rip it apart because it flows so nicely and so quickly, and not one word is wasted. in that. And so, yeah, thank you, everybody, for everyone's input. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Tim. So what's being hashed out here in our talk is, and Tim and Ram just said what it's really about. It's about the three marks of existence, isn't it?
Yes, sir.
Included in this sutta is a complete teaching on anicca, impermanence, anatta, the not self-characteristic, and the resulting stress and suffering that comes from misunderstanding those two. And it's wonderful to see that. Pull it out of here. So, thank you, Tim. Hello, Becky.
Hello. Good to be here.
Good to see you.
I'm happy to be here. I've enjoyed listening to everybody. I enjoyed reading this sutta this morning before I came. And I guess what I want to say is it's just remarkable how Sariputta, he just gave them the bottom line. In such a concise and clear and sort of easy to understand way, in a way, because he just said, you just have to come back to this, and to this, and you'll be fine.
Yeah.
Just keep, it was like just the core. And as long as you're working and from that core, you won't go astray.
That's it.
In your teaching.
Beautifully said.
And I just found that to be just remarkable, really.
It is. It is a remarkable teaching. And that Dhamma is remarkable in its simplicity. It's right there. You know. Thank you, Becky.
Thank you.
Adam, what do you think of your first class here? And you can be honest. You can say, you know, it stinks. I'm gonna...
honestly, it's there's so much fabulous mind food.
Yes.
I've gotten from this. Like Ram was kind of picturing these guys hanging out with Sariputra and him kind of telling them, keep your eyes on the prize, you know?
Yeah.
But really what I want to say is it's absolutely so refreshing and joyful to be here with you all and to hear this and hear this teaching and hear your discussion of it. It's absolutely wonderful, and I'm delighted to be here and we'll be coming again.
Great. Well, welcome to our Sangha. I can take these off. I think you said you haven't been to becomingbuddha.com yet?
Not yet, no.
Yeah, it's actually becoming-buddha.com. I think there's a card there with that address on it. Go to that webpage, if you want. I'm not ordering you to do it, if you'd like to continue. And there's a lot of information. There's 10 years of stuff on there. And don't let that overwhelm you. If you go to the home page and start from top to bottom, you'll see welcome and introduction. If you go there first and read that page, that'll start pointing you in the right direction. Just below that, you'll see guided jhana meditations. If you click on that, you'll see recordings of the meditation method we just used here with the verbiage,
okay,
from 5 to 45 minutes, and also just instructions on that. I suggest that you start with shorter periods of meditation, say even 5 minutes. What's more important about a jhana meditation practice is doing it consistently and twice a day. So in the beginning, 5 minutes might feel like it's as much as you want to do, and that's fine. There's no benefit to pushing yourself towards long periods of meditation at first. Let yourself gradually increase your time. If you're comfortable with 20 minutes right away, that's fine too. I would suggest don't go past 20 minutes for at least a couple of weeks right now. And I'm always available to everybody knows that. You have any question, or you just send me an email. But if you go to the website and start following that and continue to come to class, very quickly you'll be speaking just like these wonderful Dhamma teachers are. So, again, welcome to our Sangha. I got to rush a little bit. We usually close with something called the Metta Sutta, but I have a ride coming and I don't want to keep him waiting. So We are going to end class right now. Thank you all for...
Thank you for listening. I rely on donations to support the continued restoration, preservation, and presentation of the Buddha's Dhamma. If you find benefit here, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. Thank you. Peace.